Greetings in Jesus' precious name this morning. The last time I spoke here, we were thinking about seven keys for finding God's will. I promised at the end of that message to try to get more practical in another message, and today is the day. Have you ever committed to do something, and then when you got to it, it was harder than you thought? I am feeling a little uncertain because as I prepared for this, I realized there were some things that I will say that is a reflection of my own experience. These topics are impacted very much by our culture, not only our American culture, but our Anabaptist culture. This thing of, when should I become a Christian? Should I do voluntary service? What should my work be, and who should I marry? I don't think I'm alone in this. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 7:6, I speak by permission, not by command. And he said in 2 Corinthians 18, and herein I give advice. And so there are some messages that are clearly doctrinal and apply across a broad range of cultures and situations. And there are other messages, maybe like today. Honestly, if we had a podium rather than a pulpit, I would probably right now just move down to it. It felt more like a Wednesday evening discussion, and yet I said I would try to give you some help. And I want to say right now that if you feel differently or your family does it differently, I'm really open to that. You don't have to come to me and straighten me out. Just, children, go to your parents and see how they prefer. And parents, if you can tell me, I'd be glad for your input, but you don't have to. It's not like, I just realized there's a wide variety of different ways we could approach this. I want to add an eighth point this morning. It goes without saying, but we talked about being humble. This was in the last message. Getting counsel, praying and fasting, reading the Word, being sensitive to the Spirit, evaluating circumstances, trusting, obeying, and waiting. And today I'm going to say it now and in the middle sometime and at the end, and that is ask your parents. I know that is there at Get Counsel, but I'm specifically telling you children and teenagers and above teenagers even that you can ask your parents. Just three little words there, and that way if what Pastor Steve says is done differently in your family, they can give you better direction. I'll try to speak in somewhat broad terms this morning, and yet I realize I'm kind of burying my heart on some of these subjects too. Okay, so let's try to work on this one. When should I become a Christian? The short answer is when God calls you. That's the short one. I don't think you can miss the calling of the Spirit if you are waiting for it and living obediently in your family. I think it will be clear. I think that situations vary. In our circles, it seems like, I know you want to know an age, and so I'm going to give you one, but it's a range. It seems like in our circles that 11 to 14 is the norm, the bulk of children coming to the Lord. I want to say that we are impacted by our history and where we come from. In the old order church, it's much later, typically before marriage, if I understand right. And so if you're in the youth group and you're dating and then you apply for church membership, that's probably a sign that you're thinking about marriage. And so we have some of that angle. And then we have, on the other side, probably our Protestant evangelical people that we relate to, too, who are more at the end of child evangelism, maybe from 6 to 10. And their literature is written that way, that children need to become Christians early. I want to say that I really wanted to, in this message, try to point you to some scriptures that would give you some help, and I want to use this one this morning for this point, Acts 2:41. I want to give you something solid, but if it was really clear, we wouldn't struggle with these questions. And so I'm going to say it is a bit subjective. I will insert here that if you become a Christian earlier than 11 or later than 14, that does not mean you're abnormal. I just gave you that as a generality. Okay, so in Acts 2:41, at the very beginning of the New Testament church, then they that gladly received his word were baptized, and the same day there were added unto them about 3,000 souls. So that was probably a short instruction class, and probably they were mostly adults. But I want you to notice that they tied baptism and added unto them. And so I don't know if church membership was formal at that point, but you can read through all the epistles, and Paul uses words like among you or outside. And so there was a clear understanding of who was in the church and who was not. And I take from this verse that baptism brought people into the fellowship at some level. And Anabaptists have very much tried to read the New Testament and follow what it says. And so Anabaptists generally have come out that baptism is after you've accepted Christ and after instruction class, and it is included in baptism is church membership. Otherwise, you would be baptized into what, you might say, from this verse. And so that is where we've come out. Other churches have come out differently, but generally that's how it is, and that might push us a little more on the later side of those years because of understanding that not only are you accepting Christ as your Savior, but you are also joining the body of believers. I was thinking about people in the Bible that I could try to get a feel for when they became Christians or when they joined church, and it's tough. I will just give you a couple. Paul was clearly an adult, like he would have been a Jew, and then he transferred to Christianity, and he was very dynamic on both of those, but he was an adult man when he found the Lord, when the Lord called him, and he readily responded. Timothy, we don't know exactly. Paul said that your mother and grandmother have taught you from little up. Well, when did Timothy become a Christian? We don't really know that. He became a church leader, but we don't have a record of his conversion. And Jesus, I thought about this with today's lesson and thinking back a little bit. So if you look in, let me frame this a little bit. When the gospel is new into an area, you typically would have adults coming to the Lord, right? Becoming Christians. But in cultures where Christianity has been there for generations, you have children coming into the faith, and that's a little bit different. And so the only thing I could find was thinking about, like, in the Hebrew culture, those children would have grown up Hebrews and become full-fledged Hebrews at some point. And just looking through the Bible, it seems like that age might have been 12-ish, like Jewish culture would be 12. Not to say that you're a full mature adult at 12, but there was some symbolic step when a child becomes 12 years old. And maybe we've kind of come full circle and we're back about to that age. I'm not sure. I'm just giving you some things to think about. It's interesting that in Jesus' case, we have him going to the temple as a very small child. We have him going to the temple at specifically 12 years old. And then we have nothing until he is almost 30. And so why is that 12-year thing mentioned? Except was it a specific time in his life? That was when he was left behind and he was asking questions and even giving some answers to the religious leaders. And I thought about the Anabaptist leaders too. So they would have grown up in the Catholic Church and or Protestant maybe. And so out of that, they became Christians, like New Testament practicing Christians. They wanted to go back to the New Testament. That would have been as adults there again. Adult. Conrad Grebel, Felix Mons, those And so I didn't do a ton of research here. I realize this has moved some in different cultures. This message would look different if we were in China, probably, or India, or if we could back up 300 years. And I don't know what it would look like 300 years forward either, but I'm just saying that I'm giving you the best I would understand at this point. To close this one, I'm going to go back to say that when God calls you, I don't think you will miss it. Parents, we pray for our children. We're concerned about them. We're wondering if the Spirit is speaking to their life, and we commit them to the Lord. You know, we don't always know exactly where they stand. We can ask questions, but I'm just so blessed that we talked about miracles in the men's Sunday school class. I think one of the greatest miracles is when a person becomes a Christian and their heart changes. You can just tell. I remember that in my own life. I see it in others. There's just a heart change. Everything is new and different and much better. And the child that you thought wasn't really a problem or wasn't really struggling so deeply, all of a sudden blossoms into something beyond what you imagined. Like, it's just a change, and it's a blessing to see. Okay, point two. Should I do voluntary service? The short answer here is yes, strongly encouraged. And maybe the fuller answer is that it does not always fit every situation. I would like you to go to Mark 1 for this point. Have you ever thought about that the disciples were involuntary service, kind of? They dropped what they were doing, which I assumed paid their way, and at a moment's notice, seemingly, they embarked on this mission journey of 3 years and beyond. That is described in Mark chapter 1, starting at verse 16, as I'll read starting at verse 16. And as he walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. Maybe the emphasis there is on the word were. Then Jesus said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you become fishers of men." They immediately left their nets and followed him. And when he had gone a little further from there, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who also were in the boat mending their nets. And immediately he called them. And they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and went after him. Then they, now I think they is Jesus, Simon, Andrew, James, and John, went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and taught. I don't know if you ever saw it that way. Do you think Jesus handed out paychecks on Friday evening? I doubt. Do you think there was wonderment or doubt in their minds about their families? Do you think Peter was married at this point? Do you think that there were furloughs, like when Jesus was traveling through Galilee and Capernaum and Nazareth, that the homeboys visited their families while they were there? Maybe. Do you think there was some consternation on the part of the married couples about this whole thing? I don't know that. I'm just saying that it just seems amazing to me that they just dropped what they were doing and they did this 3 years of service, this lifetime commitment, if you will, this immediate change of occupation. Do you think that they, like, were disciples part-time and fished part-time? I kind of doubt reading through. I mean, one time Peter said, "I go a-fishing," and then it didn't work out quite like that. And so just ponder that as you think about voluntary service. Voluntary service is, in a way, an interruption into your plans. But it's a good interruption. It's a valuable thing. We were last evening at the farewell at Mountain View Nursing Home for our daughter Stephanie, and the four that spoke were all 100% recommending and appreciating that they had made the step to go there. In fact, I don't know that I can think of anyone that has done voluntary service that came back and said, it was really not a good thing. I just really messed up on that one. Have you ever heard somebody say that? I haven't. So that should give us some courage, a boost to give it some more thought. I want to also mention this element. This is coming from it from a completely different angle, but consider this. Many of our neighbors, our neighbors send their young people off for military service, of course, for the country. What do we offer as an alternate? So some of those children don't come back. And just the other week, there were many flags on 81, and I thought maybe the president was coming up the road or something, but no, it was the body of a service person being returned for burial, as I understood it. Is that what it was? I think it was.
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Don't worry about it. Well, that was my understanding of the situation that was happening. And so right now, military service is optional. But if there would be conscription or the draft or however you want to say it, and young people had to go serve, we would need to provide an alternative. And I wonder, why would we not start donating time now? I want to say at this point that voluntary service can take different, the typical might be Mountain View Nursing Home or Faith Mission Home or some other Mennonite Air Missions for a year or 2 years, and you're overseas or you're off-site and then you come back, but it can be different than that. I'm going to say that I think school teaching fits this category. I know it is done for money, but the pay is not generally on par with a normal job, if you will. There are other possibilities. People that are willing to go on these three trips that are coming up, January, February, March. I've been blessed by sons and dads and ladies and moms that are just will go and do this. My parents have cooked in the past at Maranatha Bible School. They weren't paid to do that. They went because they enjoyed it. That was, in my mind, voluntary service. I will stick in this note. It seems to me like right after high school is the best time to do voluntary service. But it's not the only time. Missions also need young couples and solid, mature families. I will add this. Beware of debt. Let's say you get out of high school, buy a car or truck that costs you $15,000 and put it on payments. Do you realize what that's doing to your future? If you decide that God is calling you to voluntary service, you have these payments. And how are you going to make those payments when your allowance is like $10 a week or whatever they might be? I'm just saying, consider that debt can really limit your ability to fulfill and answer voluntary service. And consider this too. We're going to get to this point anyway, so I'll just bring it in here. Where you serve and who you associate with there will build lifetime networks of friendships. That will affect your worldview, that will affect your standards, and that will often affect who you marry and what you do for a job. Isn't it true? That's the way that works. I just need to be honest about that. So that decision, I think, is important. The Mission Committee has compiled a brochure of voluntary service opportunities. I thought I could easily bring that this morning. It proved to be difficult. I did not have one that was current. Our printer, because of some changes we made, did not wish to work, nor did this printer. And so do we have one posted, Brother John? If we don't, I think by Wednesday evening, or no, that's nursing home. By next Sunday, we can have you a nice, it's a nice brochure. I think there are at least seven areas of voluntary service that have been researched and approved by the Mission Committee. And you wonder, well, how did they decide? Well, they probably interviewed a lot of parents that had children that were there and came home, and how the children returned? Did they return with good attitudes, with a blessing? Was it a great experience for them? Was it a good environment for them? Do we support their mission? Is it good work? And so on. And so that list I feel solid about. Not that they're perfect places, but they're good places. And not that they're the only places. There might be others. Thank you, Caleb. I appreciate that. There is one on the bulletin board. It's right beside the calendar where you normally stick stuff up. Okay, so for your information, consult that, please. Okay, let's go to point three. What should I do for a job? Let's go to Acts 23:6. This will look a bit different between the men and the ladies. As I thought about this, I wondered about Paul's experience. Paul said in Acts 23:6, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee." Well, I never thought about that. So his dad was too. He followed in the tradition of his parents and did what they did, or his dad, it seems. And it's interesting that he says, "I am a Pharisee," instead of "I was a Pharisee." I would have probably put it in the past tense for him at this point, but nevertheless, as my understanding of a Pharisee was that they were almost a professional scholar. Have you ever known people like that, that made a career out of going to school? It doesn't pay that well, but some people really enjoy learning. And then we'll back up to Acts 18, verse 1. By the way, do you think professional scholars usually work with their hands? Some do, some don't. But it's interesting to me that Paul, that was a Pharisee in the Jewish tradition, in Acts 18:1, after these things, Paul departed from Athens and came to Corinth and found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, lately come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because that Claudius had commanded all Jews to depart from Rome, and came unto them. And because he was of the same craft, he abode with them and worked. For by their occupation, they were tent makers. And I take that was not only Aquila and Priscilla, but Paul. So he made a transition, like a career change almost. I don't know how that all worked out, but he went from being a professional student to being a tent maker. And he mentions that a couple other times. In 1 Corinthians 4:12, he says, "And we labor working with our own hands, being reviled, we bless, being persecuted, we endure." And in 1 Thessalonians 2:9, "For you remember, brethren, our labor and toil, for laboring night and day, that we might not be a burden to any of you, we preach to you the gospel of God." So Paul chose tent making as his money-making occupation. You might think about Jesus, too. I spoke about him and his 12-year-old thing, but he studied under his father, Joseph, and was a carpenter, as best we know. We don't really have proof of that. They referred to him at one point that way. But at about 30, so he would have, in his teens, 20s, I don't know if he was making furniture, or if he was nailing trusses, or if he was building houses with rocks, stones, blocks. I don't know that, but he became a minister, a teacher. And so he made the shift maybe a different way than Paul did. He went from working with his hands, clearly carpenters have to do that, to becoming a preacher, if you will, and Paul kind of switched it the other way. I'm saying that there are various kinds of jobs with various kinds of people who are necessary and needed. And so a couple questions for you as you consider your vocation. What are your gifts? What do you enjoy? And what are your options? I find it fascinating that not all sons do what their fathers did. My dad was a dairy farmer all his life. I'm not a dairy farmer. But there were parts of that that I really enjoyed, and there were a few parts I didn't enjoy as much. And that's how all jobs are. I'm saying that right now. Consider some other things. Who will I be working with? Like voluntary service, your coworkers will affect your direction in life. Young people, I beg you, please do not put yourself in a worldly work environment. Maybe there's a place for that, but not generally when you're in your teens and 20s. And I realize that that's been done differently, but there are so many Christian environments you can work in. I don't understand why we would not. And I say that from the bottom of my heart because as parents, not as parents, just as 40 and 50-year-olds, we've seen too many wreckages along the way of solid young people that went off and were influenced either in college or in their job setting, and they're just not where they were. I just hate to say that, but it was a direct reflection of where they were and where they went. It makes a big difference. Later in life, you might be asking, where am I most needed, or how can I have the most impact for the kingdom? You can think about that when you choose your vocation. Someone has said, if you do what you enjoy, you will never have to work a day in your life. There's some truth in that. If you find enjoyment in what you do, you will never have to work a day in your life. I balance that by saying that all jobs have some times when you wish you were in Australia. That's normal. And the reason I say Australia is because we have a book about a boy who thought everything would be great if he went to Australia. I also say that all jobs, even jobs in perfect or nearly perfect environments, have some parts that are less enjoyable than others. That is normal. Don't let a bad day or a bad week or a tough time derail what you think you want to do or not do. That is just, sometimes we say at our house, we live in a fallen world. Well, we do. Not everything is perfect. There are coworkers, there are situations, there are things. I'll just tell you, dairy farming, I loved working in the fields, planting, harvesting, tractors. I didn't mind the manual labor, but milking cows just wasn't what I enjoyed. And it's not a bad thing. I think I could have done it the rest of my life, but there's other things I like doing better. I could say more, but we'll stop. maybe just a word to the ladies. I'll be very frank here. Most of you will end up in homes mothering children. And I don't even know if mothering is a word, so you should get an editor to look at your notes. But do you understand what I'm saying? Most young ladies will end up in homes mothering children. Maybe the caution there is not to spend a pile of money training for a career that you won't use or hardly will use. Now, there's some exceptions. I think I'm just going to hold up two for you ladies that I think are really valuable, and there are so many more, but teaching is just a really good fit because teaching can be like a voluntary service opportunity. It's a blessing to the church. And it gives you ladies experience working with children. I see that as very valuable. Working with parents, working with school boards, and co-workers, co-teachers. And so I see that as a really valuable thing. Maybe you think that, well, we just get young ladies to teach because they're available. I see it as a perfect puzzle piece fit. It fills two needs, one for the young ladies and one for the families, that are both equally beneficial, symbiotic, if you want the word. Also, I think that nursing at some level can also fill this need because mothers are mothers and children will have accidents, and nursing is not bad training to have. If you end up not married, you can make a career out of teaching. You can make a career out of nursing. I'm going to put in a plug for Mountain View here. I was not paid to do this. But you can go there and volunteer your time and come away with your CNA degree without working hardly at all. I mean, with minimal work. You can even get your RN there for very reasonable compared to other options for getting that. And so you can work coming out of that voluntary service experience, you can have tools, training that could help you provide for yourself if you need to. You also can just bless the church in many ways. Like, let's say you're going to a mission field and you're a mission field mom. School teaching and nursing are handy things to know, important things to know, maybe even life-saving things to know. I'm going to mention now for the men just a little bit. So considering your vocation, what are your options? What do you like to do? Does it pay enough to support a family? There are some things I really enjoy doing, but they are not what I would call paying vocations. So you have to make that, you have to understand that. I think it dawned on one of our children just this week that the best way to make money is to get a paycheck. And the best way to get a paycheck is to have a job. And the best way to have a job is to work hard. And so that's fairly simple, I guess, but still there are moments of truth. Also consider if it blesses the Lord and the church. Are you able to interact with people? Can you be light and salt in your work? I'll just say that one of the real blessings of working at Highland Welding was that people came to us with problems. They usually didn't stop in to pass the time of day. They had something broken, and I love fixing broken things. But it also, I did not understand it fully, but it gave us a connection to so many people in the community. So between Brother Glenn with Sugar Tree Store, Brother Dave with Mountain Oasis and Real Estate, Highland Welding, I'm missing some, Jonathan Hartzler with Roofing, Dan Freed is a doctor. That connection to the community was very, very valuable. It just was. The children still laugh, but when I go to Highland County and walk into the Rockingham Co-op, to this day, I will probably know more than half of the people in that store by name, first name. And we are hunting or something, and the truck goes down the road, and I say, there goes Charlie McNeilius. Yep, still driving the same old truck he used to drive. those kind of connections were just valuable. And so in our work, we might consider that. Think about Paul. I'm circling back to that. He worked with his hands, even if he was an evangelist. He worked in a Christian environment, even if he was a preacher. And he worked with the public and use that to build relationships and generate opportunities to share his faith. I say that as kind of an assumption, but if he was a tent maker, who do you think got tents fixed or made? I don't think they were recreational. I think they were residential. And I don't think he was probably serving nobility in that so much, but I think that if you were a common person, a nomad, I don't know how that would have worked, and your tent needed a repair, you went to a tent maker. Maybe it was different, but in my mind, Aquilas, Priscilla, and Paul had this connection of customers that they served and they knew and they worked with. Okay. Should I marry? And if so, whom? This is a tough one. I want to hold up here at the beginning Aquila and Priscilla a bit, just for a bit of a basic foundation. They are mentioned 6 times in the Bible, New Testament. I might have said this before. They are never mentioned alone, always together. Always. That is unusual. And so I'm holding them up as an example of a godly marriage without knowing much about them. But in Acts 18:2, I mentioned that verse. They moved. We know that because of Claudius sending them out of Rome. In Acts 18:18, they traveled. Paul was traveling with them. In Acts 18:26, they were hosting and teaching. That was with Apollos, I believe. And so they took this young or inexperienced preacher in and not only fed and gave him a shelter, but helped him understand Christianity better. In Romans 16:3, Paul says they were my helpers, and so they were helping Paul. In 1 Corinthians 16:19, they hosted the church. He says, the churches of Asia salute you. Aquila and Priscilla salute you much in the Lord with the church that is in their house. Well, Lyndon and Andre hosted Bethany Church way back in the day in their house while it was under heavy renovation. And it seems like Aquila and Priscilla, although they had done all these other things, they also allowed the church to meet. And in 2 Timothy 4:19, they were simply present. That's all it says. Salute Priscilla, Prisca, and Aquila, and the household of Onesiphorus. So the church also needs just people that are solidly present. Well, there's a picture of a New Testament couple, how they came together, learned to know each other, found the Lord, joined the church. We don't necessarily know. And that is kind of how this topic is to me, too. I'm not quite sure where to stop and start, but I will say a few things. Young ladies, pray and wait. That is not a helpless position. That is a godly position. Let's go to 1 Peter 3, verse 3. I'm going to read this from the Bible in basic English. Feel free to compare it to your King James or New King James Version. Specifically, Peter is speaking to ladies, and he says, "Do not let your ornaments be those of the body, such as dressing of the hair, or putting on of jewels, of gold, or fair clothing, but let them be those of an unseen man of the heart, the ever-shining ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great price in the eyes of God, and I will add men." Cultivate that meek, gentle, and quiet spirit. Avoid dressing or acting to get boys' attention. It will attract the wrong kind of boys and be a turnoff for serious, mature Christian young men. Someone has said, if you're feeling stressed about marriage, or if, or when, or who, put your efforts into being the right person, not finding the right person. That's solid advice. Young men, give this some serious thought and prayer. Ask your parents. You might be hesitant to do that. You might think you have it figured out. You might think you don't need to do that, but I think it would be good. 1 Timothy 4:12 is a verse I would like to mention for the young men. It's common. It's well known. "Let no one despise your youth," Paul says to Timothy, a younger man than him, "but be an example to the believers in word, in conduct." Yes, in conduct. Be an example to the believers in conduct, in love. Oh, so you're in love? Well, be an example in that. In spirit, in spirituality, in faith, in purity. Yes, that's so solid for young men. I'm not far removed from the young men category. You might think so, but I don't feel that way. Those are good pieces of good words for men. It is okay, young men, to give this more than passing thought. You might write a list of must-be's. And a list called I hope. And this list might look something, I did not put a lot of thought into this, but this might look like this: modest, meek, so on. This list could look like can sing, can cook, not too tall, I didn't mean that to be humorous, but you understand what I'm saying. There are some things that are extremely important, and then there are some things that you hope. And God is still able to do exceedingly abundantly above all you ask or think. Oh, for your consideration. I'm going to touch very briefly on dating. I did not plan to go here, but I don't know how to touch on this subject without mentioning it. I have three short points. I wish we could find a middle ground between our parents' generation, who dated most of the youth group, I'm serious about that, and our generation, where the first date is almost engaged. I wish we could find some middle ground there. I don't know how to help that one. I don't think either is completely healthy, but we are where we are. And so as parents and as other young people, if a couple has a date, please understand it's a learning to know each other experience. And if it doesn't generate the second date or the third date, it's okay. It's an exploratory meeting in my mind. We take it so seriously, and there's so much effort and emotion put into that first date that we have them well on the path to the marriage altar, and they are not there. I'm just being honest on that one. I do not also think it's healthy to just date frivolously. Second point, it is unwise to date anyone that you know is not marriage material. Don't build emotional, strong attachments with those who are not marriage material. That bond will need to be broken at some point if you're not going to get married, and that's a tough spot. It's a tough spot for moms and dads and young people. Spare yourself the grief and exercise caution in emotional bonds with, yeah. Third, I still think it's proper for young men to ask the lady's dad for permission to date. You might disagree. I don't mind if you do. That is where I think is the best. I see this as protection for young ladies more than anything else, not a control issue at all. And I'm not promoting arranged marriages here. But if a young man is interested in a young lady, if he goes to the young man's dad and the young man's dad does some background research, this is very common. Do you know this? It's just call their boss, call their minister, call a coworker. I don't know if you all do this or not. I'm talking about my experience. And if it's not the time or there's clearly problems, the young lady doesn't have to have the burden of telling him no. You can head that off by the dad saying, I haven't had to have this conversation yet. This is not the time, and I don't feel like you all should proceed. I hope I never have to say that, but I'm just saying that. And if the dad gives his blessing, the young lady still has the prerogative to say, I don't feel good about that, or there's no chemistry, or whatever you want to say. But I'm just saying, passing that hurdle early seems like a helpful part of the process. We could spend a little time here. Marriage is a lifetime decision. I cannot adequately communicate how much this will impact your future, your family, and the church. You can't overestimate that. Your marriage partner will change your life. Probably for the better, normally for the better, but it will impact your future. And it is a lifetime decision. I wrote this down. It is quite frank, but honestly, it is better to be unmarried than to be in a marriage that you wish you were not in. Keep in mind that when you marry the person, you inherit the family. Did you know that? The way they do things, their lifestyle, their hobbies, how they relate to their church becomes yours. They are your family. And so you may love the person, but you will become part of the family and they will influence you and you will influence them. just a word to the ladies, evaluate your options carefully. I don't know what else to say on that one. Young men, it is better not to rush into new relationships. Give this some serious thought and prayer. And the other side of this, that is, don't be too timid. Just because you tried and it didn't work out doesn't mean you can't ask again or ask someone else. That can be a hard hurdle for young men to cross. Their ego can take a serious hit if someone says no thanks. I will say the same thing I did on this point in some ways as I did on the one about when you should become a Christian. If you are seriously looking for the Lord's will, I don't think you will be able to miss who it should be. I'm going to have a hard time explaining that, but I'm going to tell you a little story here at the end. This happened to me. Hurricane Fran came through the valley in 96. I was 22 years old. It was in September. We were farming with our neighbors, and the corn crop was standing in the fields ready to chop, and it was nearly flattened. So the wind and rain blew the corn down. And our chopper that we used between the three farmers did not work to pick that stuff up. We could go against the grain, so to speak, and sort of pick it up, but then you had to drive all the way around the field and go against the grain. It would not work sideways. It wouldn't work the other way. It's really slow going, and it didn't do a good job. There were custom farmers that had big machines, big choppers, that they improvised augers on the sides of the pickup heads to pick up corn. It was the beginning of the Kemper head, I think. JP can tell you about those. So our normal routine way of corn chopping in the daylight hours among the neighbors was rudely interrupted when we needed to get custom choppers in, and they operated on their own schedule day and night because their customer base expanded extremely rapidly because that corn was laying there and it was wet and it was getting to rot and they needed to chop all they could fast. All that to say that I was driving a tractor and silage wagon most of a day and all night, and Dad never farmed at night, but I did, and between daylight and sunrise, I was sleepy, tired, fatigued, a little bit frustrated maybe with all this, but we were getting the job done, and I came around the corner of the road in Rushville, Virginia, and there was this Mennonite girl running down the road. And I thought at the time, something went through my heart. I don't know what it was. But I found out later that her name was Liddy. And she liked to run before her workday. And I thought that it was just part of my sleep-deprived brain. Like I just had no context for this except something. And it wasn't my head. It wasn't necessarily my heart. And it wasn't my gut. But there's something told me there's something here. And I never could place it. It was just one of those random things that happen in your life that you have no explanation for, but it makes a strong impression. And then 2 years later, we were teaching together at Hickory Hollow School, and I learned to know her, Lydia. I close by saying, young men, young ladies, ask your parents these questions. They'll give you solid answers.